and welcome to this podcast. Today we are talking about ADD and ADHD. I get asked thousands of questions about this. I have been in this field for the last 30 years. In my clinical practice, the predominant area that I worked in was children with learning disabilities, as well as people with dementias and mind issues and so on. But a large proportion of my patients were children that had so-called learning disabilities. And I'm specifically saying the word learning disabilities as opposed to ADD and ADHD, because ADD and ADHD, the terms, pretty much came about 30, 40 years ago. Before that, we always spoke about a person with a learning disability. Now, as we all know, every second person has ADD or ADHD. It's become almost like something that people just say, oh, I've got ADD, oh, it's my ADD, oh, I've got ADHD. And not only are we seeing school-going children that are being labeled with this, but we're seeing babies of as young as 2 and 3 and even younger, and even and adults up in to all ages. I mean, I have had people come up to me that are in their late 60s and 70s and 50s and 40s, all ages, telling me, oh, they have ADD, they have ADHD. What do I think of medication for ADD, ADHD? What do I think about ADHD? And I have to tell you that this has been a passion of mine. I have researched this intensively. I have worked with thousands and thousands of clients with the so-called problem of ADHD, ADD, and learning disability. And I'm going to unpack a lot of truths in the series of podcasts that I'm going to be doing on ADD and ADHD. Some of them might come as a shock to you. Some may you may already instinctively know. But it's also going to be a way where I'm going to give you practical tips to help you with if you've been labeled, or if you have a child that's been labeled. Hopefully these tips and things will help you as well. And I'll be referring you to various different resources as well. So let's start by actually looking at what is ADHD and ADD. What are these things? Well, the most commonly cited theory is that it is hyperactivity. Let me read you the most common definition. The most commonly cited theory is that hyperactivity is a lack of focus and impulsivity, and it results from some sort of dysfunction amongst chemicals and synapses in the brain. Now, I can say a million things about that definition, and all of them are critical. All of them are telling you that that's actually not correct at all. It's not scientific. And I'm going to drop a bomb. I'm going to tell you that ADD and ADHD are not scientific categories. There is no test to prove them. There is no biological basis. There's no blood test. People are simply labeled with ADD and ADHD based on an 18-question questionnaire. Now, when I was trained back 35 years ago, that is not how we were trained to identify someone with a learning disability. It was very, very in-depth training and very, very long and in-depth analysis to determine whether a person had a learning disability and whether it was what type of learning disability and what type of management was required. It was definitely not something that could be diagnosed by just observing a child in a classroom or by observing, filling in an 18-question questionnaire or something like that in a few minutes. That is definitely not sufficient time to determine something as deep and as complex as a learning disability. We also have currently, for about probably the last 10 years and increasing, a tremendous over-referral of people who have supposed ADD and ADHD, whereas the research shows that only around about 2 to 17% of the population have a genuine learning disability, but we're getting a referral rate of up to 70% of people of all ages for ADD and ADHD. So there's a massive discrepancy between what science actually shows and what's actually happening out there in society. And that is a big concern for myself and for us in this field. A lot of scientists and a lot of therapists who work in this field will actually say that there's an ADHD hoax that's going on. So this is a big deal. So let's unpack this and let's start talking about a couple of these points. I want to go back to the definition where it talks about the most commonly cited theory is that it is hyperactivity. So let's take the word hyperactivity. Think of just when you were a child, running around, playing, jumping on things, talking fast, talking to your friends, playing with your toys, running around with your dogs and your cats and being busy. That's normal part of childhood. Being active is a very normal part of childhood. a very important part of childhood, allowing a child to crawl around when they're little, to explore, to be able to experience things, to be able to laugh loud. And these are not abnormal things. This is normal childhood. These are normal things about childhood. So that's the first thing. So hyperactivity, we need to distinguish between normal activity and hyperactivity. Obviously, we need to look at also the current classroom environment, which is very, very, very restrictive, where a child has to sit still, look and listen. And I'm going to cover in depth about how we learn and how we listen and how we think, all these kind of things we're going to cover in podcasts. But let's consider consider the age of a child. The younger the child is, the more the child needs to move. And this is why it's very important that we allow children in school to be able to move around. Obviously, as they're getting older, they can sit still for longer periods of time. But what has been removed from the classroom and from the class, the day, a child's school day, is a lot of regular breaks where they're allowed to go outside and run around. And so very often the breaks have been reduced to smaller, they're shorter, and these children are sitting still. They're not actually doing stuff. Children need to get outside. Children need to run around. Children need to breathe fresh air. They need to play in the grass. They need to be walking and moving quite regularly in between sitting down. No one can sit down for hours at a time and constantly concentrate and focus. And there's been very interesting research showing that by just reintroducing proper breaks for these children, having extended breaks, having more frequent breaks where these children are actually allowed to move around, and bringing things like physical education where they are every day, making physical education a part of every single day, where every child maybe after first break or somewhere in the day do some sort of physical education for 10 or 15 minutes. Bringing those kind of things back into the curriculum is very important. 30 years ago and longer, this was a natural part of it. Children had regular breaks where they were encouraged to move a lot more than they are currently doing today, and where physical education was done almost 3 to 5 times a week. This has changed dramatically in the current school environment, and it's one of the first things that is chopped out of a day is the regular breaks for children. They can't just sit all day in the class and then sit all day eating, in their break eating and then go back. They have to move. When a child moves, the brain changes. When a child, the brain is designed to respond to movement. The whole body is designed to respond to movement. We need to get the blood flowing to take toxins out of the brain and out of the cells, and to increase the correct flow of oxygen and blood to the brain to increase and facilitate concentration and focus. So very often a child will have pent up energy when they're forced to sit still for hours at a time, and then they just explode and they appear to be losing concentration and so on. Another huge thing with this hyperactivity, the word hyperactivity, is I'm not denying that there are some children who generally, and adults, that generally can't keep still. But that's perhaps maybe how they think and learn. And so when we talk about thinking and learning, this is also a huge deal. We have different, each and every one of us on this planet, and there's around about 8 billion of us, have our own thinking style. And it's not made up of just one type of thinking style. You know, very often people talk about learning styles theory, which says that I learn through movement, you learn through visual, and audiovisual and movement or sound or touch are very often the most commonly cited learning styles. But research actually shows that that's not scientific. Research shows that we process through 7 different types of thinking, that every single human on this planet has all 7 different types of thinking, and each of us use them differently. And in order for you or me or your child to process information, you have to think through all 7 types of thinking. And how you, and there's a specific order that we think through, each of us. And the very first one, for example, is how you pay attention. And the second one is how you start to focus and set, etc. And so there's a digestion process that is occurring. And some people will actually pay attention by moving. Other people will pay attention by writing. Other people pay attention by looking away and kind of imagining. It's different for every person. But you can't just do one thing. Once you pay attention, you immediately have to start doing the next step in your digestive process. And the next step, you have to go through seven, like a cycle of seven in around about 7 seconds in order for you to process what you're hearing. And what we're having happen, what's happening in the current education system is that we're not being allowed to work through those seven types of thinking in our own natural way. And so those children that, and adults that pay attention by moving, even if it's just tapping their foot or wiggling their fingers or, you know, just shifting slightly in the chair, they're not being allowed to do that. So the very door opener to getting information in their head is being shut. So the other six parts of digesting the information are not allowed to happen correctly. If you don't digest thinking, if you don't digest information every 7 seconds, more or less, in the correct way, eventually you're going to lose your ability to process information well at all. And it starts creating bad memory formation, which starts creating toxicity in the brain, which starts interfering with how a child's focusing and working in an environment, how an adult's working in an environment. So we just kind of have this boomerang effect. So therefore, when we look at hyperactivity, we have to look at, number one, we have to look at what's normal for childhood. Secondly, we have to look at people's learning, how they process information through the seven types of thought. We have to be able to acknowledge that we are all different and unique. And those are two very, very practical ways. And I'm going to refer you to a resource in a moment where you can find out more about this information. But these are two very, very practical ways of actually determining, is someone genuinely hyperactive, or have they got stuck in a system that is not allowing them to think properly, and therefore their brain is filling up literally with toxic waste and they can't process. So they seem to be manifesting with a learning disability, but they actually don't. We have to address these issues. Now, there's many more issues we're going to be discussing, but I just want to refer you to a resource where you can find out more about how your these seven types of thought. I have an online app called the Perfectly You, and in that I have a lot of explanation of what I've just said in depth, and there's an actual profile that you can fill in, and it tells you how to analyze it, and there's videos, and it's very, very easy to follow. You can find it at perfectlyyou.com, and there you can learn about how your seven types of thought work together, how your unique seven types of thought that you use when you are thinking through, and your children and everything. I found this absolutely invaluable with my patients. It was the first thing that I would do in my practice. It's a tool that I developed that has different elements to it, and it's a tool that I developed over 30 years ago based on my research. It's very scientific, very easy to apply. I have different versions of it, and this one in the perfectlyyou.com online is very, very simple and easy to use, and a great way of starting to understand how you think and process information and helping you to understand what you need. So let's say, for example, that your ability to pay attention comes out as movement, and the next thing to in the digestion process is your ability to focus. You see, as soon as we pay attention, we then start focusing. We pay attention, we then focus. And then we start building a temporary memory, and there's seven things we go through. Just let's look at the first two. Let's say that you pay attention through movement, and then you focus the second part of your thinking through visual. That means that in order for you to really listen and hear and learn and benefit from that learning experience in the classroom, you need to move in some way, and very quickly, directly after that, you need to do something visual, like maybe draw a picture. Now, this is the kind of child or person who in the classroom every couple of seconds seems to be doing a wiggle and then seems to be drawing or looking away and not paying attention. And this is typically the kind of child that would get referred to my practice, and the comment from the teachers would be, they keep wiggling, they keep looking away. It's very easy to see the first two of these seven. It's not easy to see the other five because they happen fast. And the first two are very in your face. And that's generally what people notice. And so people very often mislabel the movement, like maybe a wiggle in the chair, or maybe a clicking of the knuckles, or maybe a clicking of the pen. You know, it's so different for every person, but there's a movement followed very quickly by looking away or starting to draw pictures or something on paper, or making, drawing little wiggles. And then the other five different types of thought would follow suit. But those that may give the teacher the impression of a wiggly child who keeps looking away. Meanwhile, they're not a wiggly child who keeps looking away. And if you tell that so-called wiggly child to stop wiggling and to look at you, you've just closed the door to information being processed correctly. So you lose, gosh, sometimes up to 70, 80, even 90% of what the teacher's trying to deliver. So of course you're going to develop a learning disability because you're not actually processing what's coming in, and not because you're not able, because you're not being allowed to process information in the way that you are designed to process information. So what we need to realize is that in an ideal world, you may think, well, how on earth am I supposed to accommodate for 40 children in my class? Or if you're running a corporate organization and you have 30 people under you, how are you supposed to tune into all 30 people? You don't actually have to. The way that this works is that if you are being true to how you think, and each person is being true to how they think, so we all understand our profiles, in other words, our thinking profile, then what will happen is that we naturally operate in a very tolerant way. So we actually learn to listen to each other more effectively. Each person is listening according to how they listen. So I would advise patients, parents, teachers of children that had been referred to me for so-called ADD, which when I assessed them, they did not have, well, it doesn't exist in the first place. They were having learning problems, and I would always rule out the fact that have we evaluated how they're processing information? And if they told me they wiggly and draw pictures, I would say, okay, well, according to their profile, that's how they're going to pay attention. So maybe put them on one of those exercise balls instead of a chair. You can put your child on an exercise ball, those balls that they use for Pilates or the various different exercises. And instead of a chair, they sit on that. And they just rock gently. And that gentle rocking is phenomenal in stimulating a part of the brain called the cerebellum, which then stimulates the rest of the brain. And that movement that that child is desiring, or that person is desiring, in order to focus and concentrate, is now naturally happening. Or you could give them that's one extreme. You could give them a little squishy rubberized thing that they could squish in their hand, or you could tell them to take off their shoes and they could tap their foot so the tapping doesn't irritate the person next to them. There are a million different ways, and I give a lot of information on this in my books as well. In my book called The Perfect You, which goes along with the Perfectly You online app, I give a lot of examples of how to apply this ideas for wiggling in a classroom or wiggling in the work environment in ways that stimulate your brain correctly. I also have a series called Switch On Your Brain with a 5-step learning process, where there's a short version of this profile to help you understand how you think, plus lots of ideas and examples of how to use this in a day-to-day environment. That's all for today. In the next episode, we will continue this discussion on ADD and ADHD. Thank you for listening. I'm Dr. Caroline Leaf.